Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the August 23rd, 2024 issue of The Week. The cover drawing this week has Minnesota Governor Tim Walz standing in the shallows of a marshy lake. Looks like it's about sunset. He's in fishing gear. He's got a hat on that says Coach, whistle around his neck. And he's caught a little bass, and he's got a big smile on his face. The headline is, A Good Catch? The Impact of Walz's Prairie Populism on Swing States. And we get that in the controversy of the week. We'll start today. We're going to read both the main stories. Trump fumes as Harris campaign picks up speed. What happened? Frustrated Donald Trump this week tried to reclaim the media spotlight and slow the momentum of Vice President Kamala Harris' surging candidacy, as polls showed his Democratic rival erasing his swing state lead. The nonpartisan Cook Political Report put Harris ahead or tied with Trump in six of seven battleground states. Trump has a narrow lead in Nevada and had previously led President Biden in all seven states. Meanwhile, a New York Times Siena College poll gave Harris a 4 percentage point lead in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And a Financial Times University of Michigan poll showed that voters trusted the Democratic candidate more than Trump on the economy, 42% to 41%, for the first time this election cycle. Speaking at a San Francisco fundraiser, Harris said her campaign had enjoyed a good couple weeks, but we can take nothing for granted. Sources close to Trump told the New York Times that the former president had struggled to recalibrate his campaign following Biden's exit. Fixated on crowd size, the Republican told reporters at a Mar-a-Lago press conference that the crowd he attracted on January 6, 2021, surpassed that at the 1963 March on Washington. It didn't, and falsely claimed in a string of social media posts that the estimated 15,000 people who greeted Harris at a Detroit airport hangar last week were completely AI-generated. A fake image is election interference, Trump wrote, adding that Harris should be disqualified. The Times reported that Trump had called Harris a bitch repeatedly in private. His campaign denies the claim. Prominent Republicans urged Trump to remain on message. Stop questioning the size of her crowds and start questioning her positions, said former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. In a friendly two-hour interview with Elon Musk on the billionaire's X platform, Trump claimed that Biden dropping off the Democratic ticket was a coup and called Harris third-rate, incompetent, and a radical left lunatic. He also praised Musk for his willingness to fire workers who go on strike. You're the greatest cutter, promised to close the Education Department if he wins the White House, and repeated the debunked claim that the Congo had emptied its prisons of murderers and sent them to the U.S. We're at a fork in the road of destiny, of civilization, said Musk, who has endorsed Trump. And I think you're the right path. What the editorial said. Trump, as ever, can't seem to open his mouth without deceiving and inflaming, said the New York Daily News. NPR fact-checkers detected 162 distortions and lies in his 64-minute Mar-a-Lago press conference. They included claims that nobody was killed during the January 6th Capitol riot. One rioter was shot dead by police as she tried to force her way into the speaker's lobby. And that Democrats wanted Roe v. Wade overturned. It's all fine as entertainment, but a disaster for anyone with aspirations to lead the most powerful nation on earth. Harris presents Trump as a threat to democracy, said the Chicago Tribune. Yet she's happy to steal his ideas. Campaigning in Las Vegas last week, she thundered her support for making tipped income tax-free, a clear attempt to win support from Nevada's many hospitality workers. Trump has spent 2 months pitching this popular but foolhardy policy, which would only exacerbate our nation's debt woes. So, does Harris genuinely believe it's a smart policy, or is she just playing for short-term political gain? It all adds to the sense that her campaign is all vibes and no substance. What the columnist said: against all odds, the sitting vice president is successfully positioning herself as the change candidate, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. Perhaps her low profile since 2021 has paid off, because voters don't seem to blame her for the inflation and border crisis that flared on Biden's watch. But her upbeat tone might also be bringing back memories of Barack Obama's first campaign, which was framed as an optimistic antidote to an unusually grim era. Harris likes to say at rallies, "We're not going back," referring to the Trump years. But Democrats do want to go back to the future that seemed to await them in 2008. Trump can still wrest the mantle of change from Harris Grips and Matthew Continetti in National Review. To do that, he'll have to force Harris to endorse or repudiate the radical policies she supported as a senator, such as abolishing private medical insurance, banning fracking, and decriminalizing border crossings. With single-mindedness and discipline, Trump can defeat this extremely beatable candidate. Discipline is not a word that can be applied to Trump, said Gerard Baker in the Wall Street Journal. Rather than expose Harris, he's out there repelling swing voters with remarks that are either false, obtuse, or lunatic. His repeated assertion that Biden will be back as the Democratic candidate falls into the latter category. It is this Trump who lost the presidency in 2020. The interview with Musk also did Trump no favors, said Timothy L. O'Brien in Bloomberg. His trademark rambles and frequently slurry speech gave the worrying impression of a man teetering on the brink of collapse. Any Democratic giddiness is absurdly premature, said Jana Ganesh in the Financial Times. Hillary Clinton led Trump by a much larger margin at this point in 2016, and Harris must be worried about rising jobless numbers, which hint at an economic slowdown could be on the horizon. A lot can change between now and November. After all, only a month has passed since the assassination attempt on Trump and the supposedly election-defining photo of his raised fist. It's an important reminder of the transience and tenuousness of almost all political moments. In our second main story, Ukraine grabs Russian land in surprise offensive. What happened? Ukraine expanded its cross-border assault on Kursk this week, seizing nearly 400 square miles of land in the largest foreign incursion into Russia since World War II. Several towns surrendered immediately, and many Russian conscripts fled. The surprise assault, launched over a week ago, involved artillery, air defenses, and electronic warfare. And U.S. officials told the New York Times that Kyiv hadn't informed Washington ahead of time, likely because many of the vehicles and weapons used were supplied by the U.S. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said his troops had pushed at least 7 miles into the western region of Kursk, capturing 74 settlements and taking more than 100 prisoners of war. But he said his goal was not to annex Russian land the way Russia annexed 4 Ukrainian provinces early in the conflict. Instead, the operation was intended to create a buffer zone so that Ukrainian towns near the border would be safe from shelling. Russia brought war to others, said Zelensky, and now it's coming home. Russia hastily evacuated over 132,000 people from the Kursk region and withdrew some troops from the front lines in southern Ukraine to redeploy them at the border. It also pressed a counterattack, bombing Ukrainian power facilities and causing temporary outages. President Biden, who had announced a $125 million aid package just after the assault began, said his administration was in constant contact with Kyiv and that the offensive was creating a real dilemma for Moscow. Russian President Vladimir Putin, in a televised meeting with top officials, railed against the U.S. "The West is fighting us with the hands of the Ukrainians," Putin said. "The enemy will certainly get the response he deserves." What the editorial said. Mood is critical to maintaining the fight, said The Guardian. And before this offensive, Ukrainian spirits were flagging. Now there's a renewed sense of momentum that has both bolstered Ukrainian morale and sparked another round of support from the U.S. and other allies. This encouragement was a bold gamble that may backfire, and Kyiv could pay a significant price in arms and personnel. Still, at least it has torpedoed the notion that Ukraine was sliding to defeat. Putin has been a lucky imperialist, safe in the belief that Russia was a sanctuary, said the Wall Street Journal. He benefited from Biden's misguided policy limiting Ukraine's use of American arms. But you can't win a war only on defense, especially when the invader can mass soldiers, missiles, and supplies unmolested across the border. The U.S. finally relaxed its guidance this summer, and now it should remove remaining limits on the use of ATACMS missiles. Only by threatening Putin on his own turf can Ukraine push the Russians out. What the columnists said. Ukraine's bold maneuver has upended assumptions about the war, said Ishan Tharoor in the Washington Post. With Western support for Ukraine potentially waning, especially if Donald Trump wins the presidency, the incursion gives Ukraine a bit more leverage in the form of land and prisoner exchanges for any future peace talks. Yet the end goal remains unclear. Meaningful diplomacy isn't coming anytime soon, and Ukrainian forces are still outmanned and outgunned as they battle against the odds on other fronts. "We're taking an insane risk," said Ukrainian military expert Ivan Stupak in the New Voice of Ukraine. "Our forces will have to hold this new territory while continuing to fight Russian forces to the east and south. Will Russia be coerced into moving enough troops to Kursk to weaken itself on those front lines? We won't know for weeks. Either we will beat the Russians this way and they will break, or we will break." The Kursk incursion isn't military or geographically that significant, said Benjamin Parker in the Bulwark. After all, Ukrainian troops aren't about to drive to Moscow, but as a psychological weapon, it matters a great deal. Kursk was the scene of the largest tank battle in World War II, where the Red Army defeated the Nazis, and it embarrasses Putin to see it in jeopardy. Most of all, the offensive is a rebuke to the U.S. tactic of giving Ukraine just enough support to stay alive, but not enough to prevail. The Ukrainians apparently aren't getting the message because they keep fighting like they're trying to win. And the controversy of the week, Waltz. Will his folksy appeal help Harris in the Midwest? Tim Waltz was a surprise pick to be Kamala Harris' running mate, said Lisa Lehrer in the New York Times. The governor of Deep Blue, Minnesota, Waltz didn't bring the clear electoral benefits of swing state contenders such as Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro or Arizona Senator Mark Kelly. But in the folksy, affable Waltz, Vice President Harris may have seen a battleground strategy dressed in Carhartt. In pure policy terms, Waltz has governed as an unabashed liberal, and Republicans have wasted no time in attacking his support for tampons in school bathrooms and voting rights for felons. But as a former geography teacher, union member, football coach, fisherman, and hunter who positively oozes Midwestern dad energy, Waltz could be the perfect running mate to help the California-born Harris win white, rural, working-class voters in Rust Belt states. "It's not a wild gamble," said Meredith Lee Hill in Politico. Before becoming governor in 2019, Waltz was elected to Congress six times in one of Minnesota's more conservative-leaning rural districts. His presence on the ticket by no means guarantees Harris can hold the blue wall states of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania that Joe Biden won back from Trump in 2020, but it certainly helps. "How condescending," said Isaac Shore in the New York Post. If Harris wanted to make a substantive appeal to swing voters in the blue wall states, she could pledge to reverse President Biden's disastrous economic policies or promise to start enforcing immigration law seriously. Instead, Harris is trying to sucker them into supporting her by casting a Fargo extra as her running mate. No amount of camo print clothing can conceal the Harris-Waltz ticket's devastating policy agenda for Michiganders, Pennsylvanians, and Wisconsinites. "The bigger problem is his actual record," said Liz Wolf in Reason. "For now, Republicans are focusing their attacks on Waltz's military resume. But he also has a 20-year history of tax hikes, far-left social policies, and, during the pandemic, an embrace of lockdowns and mask mandates that can fairly be described as authoritarianism. Waltz has been a disaster for Minnesota," said Andy Brin in the Chicago Tribune. "He signed bills to give illegal immigrants access to health insurance and taxpayer-funded college. And thanks to his impotent foot-dragging response to the George Floyd riots in 2020, Minnesota's Twin Cities remain plagued by crime." Waltz isn't a radical socialist, said Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman in the New Republic. He's a traditional Midwestern communitarian. The signature achievement of his governorship is a 2023 law guaranteeing every child in Minnesota's public school system a free breakfast and lunch. To his GOP critics, this is inefficient big government liberalism. In reality, it's a wise investment of taxpayer money. Well-fed kids are healthier and do better in school, and better educated students are more likely to become productive tax-paying citizens. Waltz's guiding belief, and the reason why Republicans loathe him, is that we're all in it together. MAGA types also feel threatened by his positive vision of masculinity, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon. Waltz comes across as kind, compassionate, and helpful, a stark contrast to the paranoid, rage-fueled machismo of Trump's movement. The usual Republican warnings of dangerously liberal simply won't have much traction against a candidate who, from his very core, reads more like Ted Lasso than Che Guevara. It was a bad week, good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for Sentimental Journeys after mechanical problems with his own 757 jet led Donald Trump to fly several campaign events in a charter plane once owned by his former friend Jeffrey Epstein, the late financier and sex trafficker. The Trump campaign said it had no awareness of the Gulfstream's Epstein connection. It was a good week for self-belief. After a survey found that 27% of British people believe they could qualify for at least one sport in the 2028 Los Angeles Olympics if they started training right now. And it was a good week for the halfway decent looking. After a second seven-decade study of 8,300 Wisconsinites found that those whose high school yearbook pictures were judged least attractive by a panel of modern experts, had a higher risk of premature death than their better-looking peers. But it was a bad week for black history. After Nate Holden, 95, a former California state senator, identified himself as the black lawmaker aboard Donald Trump's helicopter when it made an emergency landing in the early 1990s. Trump claimed last week that his passenger was former San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown, and that during the harrowing descent, Brown told me terrible things about Kamala Harris. It was a bad week for Focus after a Spanish man poured water over 6,000-year-old cave paintings in Andalusia, potentially causing irreversible damage in an attempt to take a clear photo of the ancient art for Facebook. Finally, it was a bad week for consent after vets in Chicago spayed Savannah, a 10-year-old Cavapoo who'd been brought in for teeth cleaning. Mistakes happen, but this was a big mistake, said owner Ashley Martin Jenkins. And the briefing this week, the school choice wars. Are school voucher programs a boon for families or an attack on public education? What are school vouchers? They are state and local programs that let families use public funds to pay for a private K-12 education. The subsidies vary by state, but offer up to $16,000 per student per year, often enough to cover the full cost of tuition fees. When the first school vouchers were introduced in the 1990s, they were aimed at specific groups of disadvantaged children, disabled students who could benefit from a more specialized education, or those from low-income families stuck in failing schools. In recent years, these programs have exploded in popularity. About 1 million of the nation's 55 million K-12 students are now enrolled in voucher-style programs, double the number a few years ago. The programs have also become less targeted. Since 2022, 11 states have passed universal voucher programs open to all or nearly all children. Project 2025, the Heritage Foundation's Handbook of Policy Recommendations for a Second Donald Trump Term, endorses universal school choice. And Trump campaign spokesman Stephen Chang has called it an issue that should unify voters of all backgrounds. It doesn't. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona has described vouchers as part of a strategy to destroy public education. How widespread are these programs? 29 states, most led by Republicans, and the District of Columbia now offer public subsidies for private schooling or homeschooling. 8 states created or expanded voucher programs last year, and so far this year, Alabama, Georgia, and Missouri have approved or expanded such programs. This rapid growth has been fueled by recent Supreme Court rulings that have eroded long-standing constitutional prohibitions against public money being spent on religious education. Most voucher recipients now attend faith-based schools, according to a Washington Post investigation of 5 states with expansive programs: Ohio, Wisconsin, Indiana, Florida, and Arizona. We are, as a society, underwriting religion, said Richard Katsky, a First Amendment specialist at Duke University School of Law. Are there benefits to vouchers? The option of a state-funded private education, supporters say, frees parents to choose a school that's a better fit for their child without the burden of paying taxes and tuition. It's a popular message. Polling from pro-voucher group EdChoice shows that 73% of Americans support voucher availability. They are helping people who don't have the resources, said Shamika Williams, a Florida hospital worker who sends her 17-year-old daughter to a private Christian academy with state support. Conservative proponents also argue that vouchers make both public and private schools more accountable. If a school is failing academically or pushing progressive teachings on sexuality, gender, and race, then parents can pull their children out and spend the voucher elsewhere. School choice, said Betsy DeVos, Trump's former education secretary and a major backer of voucher initiatives, frees families from forced indoctrination. What do voucher opponents say? They argue talk of choice masks a campaign to make education more unequal and unaccountable. Public schools are paid for largely by per-pupil funding, so when students go private, their state funding leaves the public system. Meanwhile, universal voucher programs can cause states' education bills to rise because they are open to wealthy families who would otherwise pay their own private school tuition. Private schools also have no uniform system measuring instruction quality, and many are free to refuse disabled or LGBTQ applicants. Some of the staunchest opponents to vouchers has come from rural areas without private schools, where the local public school is often the lifeblood of the community. I don't think it's very fair, Melissa Williamson, a mother of three from Texas town of Cushing, said of a planned voucher program in the state. If a parent wants their child to go to a private school, they should have to pay for it. Do vouchers boost student performance? The data is murky and contested. Voucher advocates argue more competition produces better outcomes for all, and one 2017 review of studies focused on city and state voucher initiatives found small improvements in local public schools. Other researchers indicate neutral to positive relationships between voucher programs and graduation rates. More recent data tells a different story, with low-income voucher recipients in Louisiana, Ohio, and Washington, D.C., seeing no improvement or even declines in test scores. In Louisiana, one study found that voucher recipients experienced double the level of learning loss of those affected by Hurricane Katrina. What's next for vouchers? Texas is expected to pass a universal voucher system next year. GOP state lawmakers from rural areas had blocked previous attempts to pass such a program, but many of those Republicans lost in spring primaries to candidates bankrolled by conservative megadonors such as DeVos and Jeff Yass. Should Trump win the White House in November, Project 2025 recommends that the $18 billion in annual Title I funding for low-income schools be rerouted toward vouchers. With 58% of Americans rating public schools as poor or just fair, there's a genuine public appetite for change. But lost in the debate, University of Texas professor Huria Jabbar argues, is the U.S. education system's ultimate purpose. Vouchers really shift the concept of education to a private good, she said. But education is a public good, meaning that it benefits not just individuals, but society as a whole. And it's time for a few of the best columns. The first two come from the U.S. The anti-Israel left isn't going away. If Democrats hoped that the rage of the anti-Israel left would be quieted by the nomination of Kamala Harris, said Noah Rothman, they've been sorely disappointed. Protesters disrupted Harris' campaign speech in Detroit last week, chanting, "Kamala, Kamala, you can't hide. We won't vote for genocide." An irritated Harris responded, "If you want Donald Trump to win, then say that." The Democratic crowd cheered, but the problem posed by these protesters isn't going away. As vice president, Harris had been seen as the Biden administration's foremost critic of the Israeli government's war in Gaza, and many college demonstrators thought that she was one of their own. As a presidential candidate, Harris has come out in favor of a ceasefire and hostage release, but has refused to accept the activist demand that she support an arms embargo on Israel and other extreme anti-Israel policies. So now pro-Palestinian demonstrators are still planning to show up in force at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. Local law enforcement is preparing to respond with vigor if protesters turn violent. If violence with the pro-Hamas left breaks out in Chicago, it will only serve to remind voters of the salience of Donald Trump's law and order message. A gold medal for Title IX's impact. The U.S. is now the land of Title IX, said Christine Brennan. Our female athletes won a record 26 gold medals at the Paris Olympics, 65% of the country's total gold medals. For the fourth consecutive summer games, American women earned more medals than American men. This is no accident. Their success is what happens when a nation passes a law in 1972 that mandates sports participation for all of the children and young adults in the country, not just the male half. 50 years later, the groundbreaking law has created generations of strong, confident, highly skilled young women, and the historic domination by gymnast Simone Biles, cyclist Kristen Faulkner, swimmer Katie Ledecky, and other American athletes occurred only because they were born into a national mindset of women's athletic excellence. In 1964, teen swimming star Donna de Verona earned two gold medals, but then retired because there were no collegiate swimming programs for women. Without Title IX, Ledecky would never have won nine gold medals over four Olympics. She and so many other American women we watched in Paris have always believed they could compete and win, and we have Title IX to thank. This column comes from New Zealand. What a Kiwi man can get away with. God, I'm jealous of Robbie Manson, said Verity Johnson in Stuff. The gorgeous gay New Zealand Olympic rower recently revealed that he supplements his sports stipend by sharing raunchy paid content on his OnlyFans site. Did anyone shame him for that? Nope. We all just nodded and said, yep, that's understandable. Athletes don't get paid much, and with the ongoing cost of living crisis, well, he clearly needs to pay to get to Paris somehow. Manson is using his chiseled bod and skills with a ring light to cash in, and good for him. After all, if Aphrodite gave me a chin sharp enough to cut baking paper on it, I'd do the same. But can you imagine the reaction if it were a female Kiwi athlete who admitted to posing online for money? We'd have crucified her for desecrating the sanctity of the sport, castigated her for disrespecting her position as a role model, and probably dropped her from all of her deals. Of course, many of those flaying her alive would also be surreptitiously typing in their credit card details. Now, I'm not suggesting that I want every athlete to be doing OnlyFans. Honestly, I'd rather we just paid them properly. But I do wish we could evolve to the point where women would get the same high five that Manson got. And our feature article, The Last Word, The Story of a Colt. The mythology of the Wild West is filled with ruthless outlaws and cold-blooded lawmen, said Katie Roberts in the Washington Post. The real good guys get less fanfare. Getting rid of family heirlooms is a lost cause for many of us. Baby boomers. Younger relatives don't want our grandmother's Haviland teacups. cinnabar bracelets, or even the porcelain moose pitchers made in pre-World War II Czechoslovakia. Judging by similar offerings on Craigslist and eBay, no one else is interested in this stuff either. Its only value lies in its connection to people we knew, loved ones who were long gone. My mother had no use for the bounty of fragile objects she offloaded on me, but maybe she hung on to them because they reminded her of her parents' middle-class resilience in Depression-era Kansas. My father's side had no such trove. My paternal grandfather had been lucky to inherit a farm when he was in his early 20s, but it all blew away in the Dust Bowl. When he died in 1957 at age 69, he was scraping by as a bellhop at the Brown Palace Hotel in Denver and living in a rundown rooming house with my grandmother and the few possessions they had left. She had a Royal Dalton rose jar and a Georgian silver set. My grandfather Morris had only one treasure, an old revolver with a notch carved on the handle. Why, I wondered, nearly 70 years later, did he cling to that beat-up thing, even after he lost everything else? He had gotten it and the farm from his foster father, a lawman in post-Civil War Kansas named George Nelson Moses. The gun eventually ended up with my brother, who lived for years in Dodge City, Kansas, and stashed it at a place called, yes, Gunsmoke Storage. He finally gave it to me to deal with. My first step was to get an estimate from an online auction site. Though the gun was scratched up, the appraiser identified it from photos as an 1860 Colt Army revolver, standard issue in its day, valued between $1,000 and $2,000, depending on its origin. I naively thought a Kansas Historical Museum would want it, but these places can be picky. They urge you to document an object's history, hire a real appraiser, and get a notarized affidavit. At first, there was little to go on. My father died in 1970 when I was in high school, so if family stories were told about the gun and GN, which was how the older folks referred to George Moses, I wasn't paying attention. I did, however, vaguely recall one thing my grandmother said. GN had no use for Wild Bill. It didn't take long, thanks to Kansas County Histories and newspaper archives, to discover that Moses' revolver was far more interesting than my grandmother's precious rose jar. The story is both astonishing and, considering the way the history of the American West is told and remembered, completely predictable. I'll start with the astonishing part. When we think of the Wild West, Kansas and Missouri don't spring to mind, but both states were epicenters of lawlessness after the Civil War. Jesse and Frank James and Cole Younger were Confederate guerrilla fighters in Missouri in the mid-1860s, before they became bank-robbing killers. Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson courted trouble as lawmen in Dodge City. James B. Hickok, Wild Bill, and Texas outlaw John Wesley Hardin sized each other up in Abilene, Kansas, where Hickok was briefly the sheriff in 1871. America was already gaga over Wild Bill, thanks largely to a fulsome 1867 article in Harper's New Monthly Magazine about his supposed exploits. The bank-robbing Dalton brothers would leave their mark in Kansas later. Moses' initiation into this violent world came early. He joined the Union Army in 1861 at 17, and his right forefinger was shot off during the battle in Tennessee. It must not have affected his shooting because after the Civil War, he was recruited for a small Union militia, all expert horsemen and dead shots who could be relied upon to face any danger, as he later described them. Their job was to track down Confederates who were still causing mayhem in Missouri. Among the rebel bushwhackers was Archie Clement, who slaughtered and sometimes scalped unarmed Union captives and led a gang that included the young James brothers. When Clement was spotted drinking in a hotel bar in Lexington, Missouri, on December 13, 1866, Moses was one of three militiamen sent to arrest him. Witnesses largely confirmed his shot-by-shot description of the wild gunfight that ensued, and historian T.J. Stiles cited it in his biography of Jesse James. Moses said their aim was to arrest Clement, but after the militiamen had sidled up to the bar, a fourth, more hot-blooded member of their group burst through the front door and yelled, "Surrender!" Clement lunged through a side door into an office. Moses went after him. "Just as I slipped into the door, Clements turned and fired at me, the ball going through my clothes but not drawing blood," Moses wrote. "I fired at him, hitting him in the right breast, crippling him badly, which accounts for his poor shooting after that." The gunfight secured the legend of Little Archie, who, though badly wounded, scrambled into the street and climbed on his horse while being shot at by Moses and others. His dying words, according to various sources, were, "I told you I'd never surrender." Moses said his actual last words were, "Oh, hell," but that doesn't make as good a story. In dark corners of the internet, Clement lives on as a rebel martyr, and you can find directions to his supposed Missouri gravesite, adorned with a Confederate battle flag. That Jesse James idolized this psychopath as one of the noblest boys and vowed revenge only magnified the mythologizing. When the rebels subdued in Missouri, Moses headed west. Like Hickok, Moses hunted buffalo and worked as a marshal and scout. He ranged through lawless settlements in Colorado and the Southwest before he helped found the central Kansas town of Great Bend, where he served as the first sheriff from 1871 to 1875. The new town was on the Santa Fe Trail, and it was soon plagued by disorderly Texas cowboys on cattle drives. Saloons, brothels, and gambling halls sprang up to serve them. If Great Bend failed to achieve the notoriety of Dodge City or other cow towns, Moses' fellow townsfolk gave him much of the credit. Before Moses was sheriff, he could be as cocky as any famous gunslinger. At a construction camp in western Kansas, where the gamblers, painted women, and thugs were robbing several hundred railroad laborers, a Santa Fe surveyor, David Heitzer, told of how Moses went to a bar to collect a debt from a saloon keeper who refused to pay him back. It made GN mad, and he kicked him out of the place and took charge of the saloon himself, Heitzer wrote. We believe that Jim Gainsford was with him at the time. The saloon man went out and gathered his gang and went back to fix GN. The latter was ready and had Gainsford stationed behind the door. When the gang filed in, GN trained two guns on them and invited them to get out and stay out. He ran the saloon for 2 days, took in $68, and then turned it back to the owner and said that he had collected the interest due at least. Moses looked the part of the western gunman. Heitzer first met him when he galloped into a railroad labor camp one evening on a white pony. He was 6 feet tall, straight as an Indian, wore a slouch hat, a blue shirt opened at the throat, pair of buckskin trousers fringed down the seams, and top boots. His face was bronzed by the desert sun, his features were hard and stern, and to emphasize the cast, a pair of Navy 44s were slung from his belt. But through it all shone a pair of eyes as blue, clear, and true as the sky above us. If that sounds gushy, you aren't a reader of Wild West biographies. Hickok especially dazzled everyone with his Herculean chest and long wavy silk curls, one of the most perfect types of physical manhood I ever saw, George Armstrong Custer said. But my grandmother was right. GN did not speak well of Hickok. Wild Bill was a dead shot and a quick man on the draw, But he was a sneak with the gun and wanton with the same, Moses is quoted as saying in a newspaper reminiscence. He killed many men without provocation and without giving them a chance for their lives, and took undue advantages. Hickok's fabled career as a lawman in Abilene lasted only a matter of months. He joined an entertainment troupe of Buffalo Bill Codys, but soon quit and made his living playing poker. He was 39 in 1876 when he was shot dead from behind in a gambling hall in the Dakota Territory town of Deadwood. Moses would have a longer and nobler life. After serving as Great Bend Sheriff, he was elected mayor several times, and he and his brother built a successful mercantile business. He was on the board of three banks, and he owned an ice plant and rich farmlands. He testified in a U.S. Supreme Court case on water rights for Kansas farmers. He and his wife, who had no biological children, helped support local orphans. They took in my grandfather when he was a toddler. When Moses died of cancer in 1911 at 67, the Great Bend Tribune ran two pages of tributes, and businesses closed for his funeral, describing him as one of the best-known peace officers in the West. The eulogist said he did not get his due. He never boasted of his deeds and never played up the part he played in early day incidents that belonged to him. All that's left is his Colt Model 1860 Army percussion revolver with a notch on the handle. I recruited a top expert in vintage firearms who, taking into account the history of its owner, estimated the gun's value at $15,000. A historical society will want it now. So what is the predictable part of this good guy with a gun tale? America remembers and even lionizes the gunslingers and stone-cold killers and hucksters of the Wild West. But it forgets other people who were no less fearless, but more bent on keeping the peace and founding churches than hanging out in brothels and preening for East Coast reporters and photographers. This fascination extends to the value of the guns these storied characters carried. Jesse James, that great bank robber, in the words of former President Donald Trump, had the same model revolver as Moses had. With its belt and holster, it sold in 2009 for $230,000. A Colt 45 belonging to Wyatt Earp, who was both a lawman and a reputed brothel pimp in Wichita, went for $225,000 in 2014. The Smith & Wesson revolver Hickok was reportedly carrying when he was killed sold for $235,000 in 2022, and a rifle of his brought $475,312 in 2021. A Colt revolver he was said to have owned sold for $616,875 in 2022. I will never know what is so special about the gun George Moses passed down to my grandfather. Does the notch mean it was used to shoot someone who needed killing? Someone like Archie Clement? Does it matter? The gun's real value has nothing to do with its death count. What matters is the mettle of the forgotten man who carried it, as reflected in how he was eulogized in 1911. Civilization is in overtaking him did not change him. The man of modesty, the man of courage and strong convictions, the man of great strength and physical prowess, he was to be feared in any encounter, and he had many. They found him right in character. It was in his blood. A version of this story was first published in the Washington Post. We'll pick up one of the technology articles this week. NASA and Boeing lost in space. Ever heard of a travel delay lasting 8 months? Asked Marina Corinne in the Atlantic. That's the scenario playing out right now for two astronauts stuck aboard the International Space Station. Butch Wilmore and Suni Williams took off in Starliner, a Boeing-built spacecraft, in early June for what was supposed to be an 8-day excursion. But Boeing's first crewed mission has now unraveled so badly that NASA is seriously considering whether Starliner is capable of bringing Wilmore and Williams home at all. It seems the Starliner's thrusters malfunctioned when the spacecraft approached the ISS for docking, and they're still not in working order. The uncertainty has forced NASA to look into alternative rides. Boeing disagrees, said Eric Berger in Ars Technica, saying that enough is known about the problem to safely fly. But NASA doesn't sound convinced. It has been quietly working for a week with SpaceX on a potential rescue mission, though that wouldn't occur until February 2025. NASA is linked at the hip to Boeing, which is one of its key suppliers, said Thomas Black in Bloomberg. That's why the agency has been reluctant to speak about potentially enlisting rival SpaceX to save the day. But the clock is ticking. NASA is running out of time to return Starliner before throwing off schedules of other missions. Fortunately, the astronauts seem to be doing just fine. They even say that the extended stay is a bonus. Still, it's another black mark for Boeing. This test flight was originally scheduled for 2017, said John A. Torres in Florida Today. 8 years later, they're still finding problems. Boeing is currently conducting thruster testing at their facility in New Mexico to gauge what temperature the thrusters can tolerate. But Boeing got this contract in 2010, and we're still talking about building confidence in the spacecraft. Houston, we have a problem. The problem is where NASA can go from here, said Mark R. Whittington in The Hill. The original principle of the Commercial Crew Program, the agency's much-discussed decision to retire the space shuttle in 2011 and enlist private help to fly astronauts to space, was that there must be at least two ways to take astronauts to and from low Earth orbit. Space and Boeing were the two primary choices, but NASA now has to wonder, can Boeing be trusted? Alternative partners are limited. Sierra Space is one possibility, although it has yet to even launch an unmanned test of its spacecraft. Indian's Gaganyaan is scheduled to fly with a crew sometime in 2025. Neither of those, though, solves the immediate problem, and NASA desperately doesn't want to go hat in hand to the Russians for rides on the Soyuz again. And one of the short science pieces, how fish save energy. In Olympic cycling races, you often see teammates racing tightly together in what's known as a peloton to enable those in the middle to travel at the same speed using less energy. It turns out that fish swimming in schools enjoy the same benefits, reports the New York Times. Researchers put giant danio, a small species found in freshwater creeks, in a controlled current environment, like kind of a water treadmill, and used a probe to measure their oxygen consumption when they swam alone or in schools. They found that in turbulent conditions, meant to mimic small whirlpools, the schooling fish swam even closer together than normal and expended as much as 79% less energy compared with lone swimmers. And whereas the solitary fish used 22% more energy in turbulent waters than they did when it was calm, the group fish exerted no additional effort. Study leader Yangfan Zhang from Harvard University says the similarities to a peloton are striking. There is something really unifying about a principle that happens across biology, he says. We can learn a lot from nature. And a few of the short notes. Some 76,000 Americans died of COVID last year, 69% fewer than in 2022, according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control. That put the disease as the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. last year, down from 4th in 2022 and 3rd in 2021. This year, Political Post had made up about 17% of Elon Musk's feed on his social media platform X, up from 2% in 2021. Over that same period, the billionaire's posts about his companies Tesla and SpaceX have dropped from 30% of his feed to about 13%. China's urban pet population is expected to hit 58 million this year, equal to the country's population of children under age 4, with a growing share of younger Chinese opting for cats and dogs over starting a family. The under-4 population is expected to drop to 40 million by 2030, while the number of urban pets will hit 70 million. If Vice President Kamala Harris wins the 2024 election, she will make history as the first woman U.S. president and the first president to have worked at McDonald's. Some 41 million Americans, or over 13% of the population, have been McDonald's employees at some point in their lives. Harris worked at the fast food chain for a summer while she was in college. On the poll watch, J.D. Vance's unfavorability rating has increased 12 percentage points to 43% since Donald Trump selected him as the Republican vice presidential candidate in July. And we'll finish with a quote from Bill Nye the Science Guy, who says, "To leave the world better than you found it, sometimes you have to pick up other people's trash." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.